about. And that includes restoring God's view for the family. If you're not married yet, allow me to give you a scary peek. I think most everybody's married, but there's a few people who aren't. Allow me to give you a scary peek into what marriage is like. Brace yourselves, guys. This husband says, started a movie 45 minutes ago with my wife. We're 7 minutes in. If you've ever watched a movie with your wife, you know that's the case. Here's one more. Just once, husband says, I wish when my wife says, we need to talk, she surprises me and starts up a conversation about Mexican food. I've been married for 9 years. It's not happened yet. Maybe one day. Here's another one. My wife and I have a rule. Whoever, unless I'm driving, then she controls the radio. This is just a terrible situation. One last one for you. Mark here says, marriage is about finding that special someone to disagree with about the room temperature until you die. I like those. I think those characterize marriage pretty well, at least in a humorous light. But in light of these terrible tales of woe, it's no wonder that marriage is on the decline. Here we have a chart. We have the, I think this works, the blue line here. That is the marriage rate, and this goes back about 150 years. There's a few anomalies. If you see, there's World War I, there's the Great Depression. After all the boys get back from World War II, right before they leave and after many of them get back, huge spikes of marriage during the Great Depression, a huge dip in marriage. But overall, the past 100 years before, prior to the 60s and 70s, marriage has been relatively stable, okay? But what do we see happening in the 80s and 90s, especially, marriage all of a sudden plummets. So the blue line you see just going down very steeply. Gen Xers and millennials, that is people who are in their 50s and earlier, so the 20s to 50s, people who are in those two generations, they're foregoing marriage and simply living together, cohabiting in record rates. In one generation, the number of people cohabiting together has increased 15-fold, 15 times more people cohabiting today than a generation ago. Why? Is it because of scary stories that we just talked about, like the Mexican food and the temperature? And it's not necessarily that. Is it because marriage is looked down upon as a relic of the past? It's no longer needed these days. You know, it's just a piece of paper. You know, love is more pure if it's free and you kind of do whatever you want. That's not it either. But you might think that. You'd be very wrong, though. If you look at the orange line, right here, you see the blue line going down, but right before the blue line starts going down, you see this orange line shoot up all of a sudden. You see that orange line, that is the divorce rates. In the 70s, and really starting in the 60s, it skyrockets. So what happened is people who were born to those marriages, to those families in the 80s and 90s and even to the 2000s, they saw their parents divorce in record numbers. And most people, most children who grew up in a split family describe the divorce as deeply painful and a defining event in their lives. There's a quote that somebody says, simply, devastating, devastating. And speaking out of personal experience, that is certainly the case. When asked, millennials don't have a low view of marriage. They have such high respect for marriage, they're terrified to get it wrong. Why are many people cohabiting today? They're terrified of ending up in a divorce like their parents. They so badly want this marriage relationship to work that they're doing things that, maybe the cure is worse than the disease, but at the very least, there's a silver lining in this. You know, yes, people are cohabiting today, but the reason isn't out of a disrespect for God's order, disrespect for marriage, not at all. It's because marriage is held in such high esteem today. When millennials, especially, they're polled, I believe the latest Pew research that I saw is millennials out of any generation alive today have the highest respect for marriage. So it's definitely not because marriage is simply seen as a relic of the past. It's simply because they don't want to mess up like their parents. They know what it feels like for a family to go through a divorce. So If we're going to restore the biblical view of marriage, step one, I think we're largely already there, is to have respect for it. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4 says, let marriage be held in honor among all. And certainly everybody doesn't respect marriage, but largely we're there already. So step two, on the other hand, we can't be so afraid of something, marriage, if we're talking about marriage, we can't be so afraid of divorce that, you know, hey, the solution is, let's just never get married. Never get married, never get divorced, right? That's not a good solution. It's like if you're afraid of not finding your socks, well, let's just chop my legs off. No legs, no need for socks, right? So the solution doesn't really help. We can't be so afraid of going off the road on one end that we, you know, fall into the ditch on the other end. So what is the solution? I think step two, after step one, having respect for it, step two is to better understand marriage and what causes some marriages to end. We can't let our fear of failure in one area. So if we understand it better, then perhaps that can help us to prevent it and fight off the apprehension we have of marriage. So the fear of marriage, of getting married, is largely falling out of love. If you ask people, you know, I'm afraid that we might fall out of love, or, you know, what if we're just incompatible? What if it doesn't work out? And so these concerns, they indicate really deep misunderstanding about what love is and how it works. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt sums it up very well. He has a whole book on this topic. He sums it up very well. He says, the modern myth of, you know, quote-unquote true love, think Hollywood, every romantic movie in Hollywood, the modern myth of true love involves these beliefs. True love is passionate love. It burns bright like fire and never fades. You fall quickly into true love. It's wildly emotional, and so you should marry that person. If the passionate love ends, then you should leave that person because it wasn't true love. And if you can find the right person, he calls him, this is the concept of the soulmate. You know, if we were really soulmates, then I wouldn't have fallen out of love. You know, so let's leave each other and we'll go look for our soulmates. If you can find that right person, then you'll have true love forever. So if the metaphor for this passionate kind of love is fire, on the other hand, the metaphor for what he calls companionate love or friendship love, the love of a companion, is vines growing together, intertwining and gradually binding two people together. Companionate love is the deep affection that grows slowly over the years as they begin to rely upon, care for, and trust one another. So Dr. Haidt charts the two different kinds of love he describes in a relationship, and he notices a couple of danger points. So this is on the y-axis, we have the intensity of feeling. So looking up, that's the intensity of the feeling. And then on the x-axis, we have the time. So we're looking at a relatively short period of time here. The dotted line is the passionate love, and then the solid line down below that is the companionate love. So the two danger points, the first one being at the very, very top, this is when passionate love is at its temporary peak. He describes it quite literally as being high on drugs. And he makes a comparison that people aren't allowed to sign contracts when they're drunk, and neither should they be able to be engaged in marriage while they're high on passionate love. It has much the same kind of consequences. So people are high on this passionate love, and that is often when they get married. And then shortly thereafter, there's this precipitous dip. And then it comes back just a little bit if they stick it out. And then it kind of goes up and down, and it's kind of this fickle thing. But all the while, companionate love starts off small and almost non-existent. And it slowly grows and grows and grows over time. So if people get married up here, when it dips, that's often the time when divorces happen. They say, we fell out of love. We lost the feeling. This is why, you know, so many Hollywood marriages end after just a year or two or three or maybe weeks because, you know, we fell out of love. It just wasn't meant to be. So they quit because they're blindsided when the passionate love wanes, but just before the stronger, more lasting companionate love begins to build. So companionate love here in this graph looks kind of weak because it can never attain the intensity, the strength, the heights that the passionate love has. And he describes later in the book, if you want to read it, that's a very, very good thing because, you know, you can't think, you can't focus on things, it makes you crazy, okay? But if we change the time scale from a relatively short time period to maybe a lifetime, a whole marriage, 60 years, we see that it's passionate love that seems trivial. It's a flash in the pan. If you look, It's just a quick blip on the radar, and then it's basically just kind of hums along at a low rate, and then companion love just takes off and it lasts a lifetime and it continues to grow. When we admire a couple still in love on their 50th anniversary, I think, Gary, we just celebrated your 50th anniversary, didn't we? And some people here have been married for much longer than that. When we admire a couple that's been married for 50 years, it is this blend of loves, but mostly companionate with a little bit of passion still in there. It's that blend of loves that we're admiring. The love that undergirds strong marriages is simply strong companionate love with some added passion between two people who are firmly committed to one another. So we have no fear of, reason to fear falling out of love if we understand how it kind of works and how it typically works. Expect that blinding passion early in the relationship to ease a bit, though hopefully not completely, so that you can make room for true love and for true friendship to build and to be cultivated. If we understand this before we get married, we stand a much better chance of our marriages lasting. Now, husbands, how are we to treat our wives in a way that honors God, but not only avoids divorce, but strengthens and restores the biblical view for our families? I see a few people laughing. I think that's funny because it's true. Did you know, this was a very kind of surprising fact to me, out of all the divorces are skyrocketing, you'd think that, you know, approximately half of them, the husband is divorcing the wife, and half of them, the wife is divorcing the husband. That's not true. The stats that I've seen, it's upwards of 80% of all divorces are initiated by the woman. Your wife is far more likely to leave you than you are to leave her. I think there's a few reasons behind that. Part of it is I think we as husbands tend to let our relationships go on cruise control or relational autopilot. If we do that, we might wake up one day and realize that our marriage isn't what it once was, or maybe it's not even there at all. There was one expert who works with women frequently who are going through divorce, and she characterized it this way. She says, women seek closeness and vulnerability in marriage, where it's safe to be real and raw with our chosen one. When she reaches out for that connected feeling and is met with the quote-unquote wrong response, she lays down a brick. Then one day, the wall is too high to penetrate. The internal process for a woman usually starts with her wondering why she is so unhappy. She works on herself by reading self-help books. Maybe she seeks counseling, starts exercising, or does some form of self-development. At some point, she feels a little bit better, but something is still off. She may feel lonely, so she looks closer at her marriage. Looking at the marriage under a microscope now reveals a multitude of infractions. He doesn't help around the house. He doesn't do his share to take care of the kids. He doesn't buy her gifts. He doesn't spend time with her. He doesn't listen. He doesn't connect with her at all. As a matter of fact, the marriage just feels empty to her as she investigates all of its faults. And she wraps up by saying, all of these women who are going through a divorce, and particularly women who are initiating divorce, they all have the same, a similar version of saying, I felt so lonely. I felt so lonely. What's the answer then? How are we as husbands to restore God's view of the home? I think the most practical summary of a godly husband is in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. We'll be spending some time there if you'd like to flip there. If not, we have it up on the screen. 1 Peter chapter 3, in verse 7, it reads, husbands likewise dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. And we'll stop there. There's more we can break down, but we'll just take a look at the first part of the verse. So the first part, husbands dwell with them. This word dwell with is literally in the original, together homing. Together homing. And this indicates some level of time spent with them, positively interacting with them, conversing with them, helping them. In a few years that I've been married, Jeanette has sometimes commented to me that I feel like we're just roommates. Danger, danger, danger. They're not to be treated as roommates. You know, we check on them every month or so to make sure they're still alive. That's not how it's supposed to be. God says we're supposed to be building a home together with them. That's what this is. Dwell with them. Okay, and next part, here's the key. With understanding. And this is the very hard part. It's no secret that men and women think differently. Men, generally speaking, tend to be more interested in things. Data, numbers, tools. What jobs do men, are men overrepresented statistically? Engineering, mechanics. When was the last time you saw a female mechanic? You might have seen one. When was the last time you saw a female engineer? It's growing now with all the STEM field stuff, but typically men are programmers. Men are, these are the jobs where you can work with data and do things with other things. These are the jobs that men tend to like. Women, on the other hand, they tend to be more relational, focused on emotions, people, connecting. What are the jobs that, if women had the choice, what are the jobs that women tend to choose? Early childhood education, nursing, things where they can take care of and interact with people. The psychology field is almost completely dominated by women. This is, of course, there's exceptions and there's some overlap, but this is the statistical norm. Go to the toy aisle and see for yourself. Boy toys tend to have wheels. Girl toys tend to have faces. Right? These are, you know, things that they can interact with relationally. And boy toys tend to be things that can build and things that go and things that shoot. That just tends to be how it is. I've got an example. This is a hammer. It's got steel, and I think this is fiberglass or something, I'm not sure, and rubber. This is a hammer. If I hammer something with it, I don't tell it, "Hammer, good job. Thank you, hammer. I appreciate your hard work hammering that stuff for me." It doesn't care if I talk to it or how I talk to it. I can put it in a drawer for a couple of years and just forget about it. And then, I have a hammer. I'm going to come back, and the hammer, there it is, still faithfully waiting for me, good as new, ready to go. You want to hammer some stuff? Yeah, let's hammer some stuff. Okay, this is men. Okay, this is men. Can't do that with your wife. You can't just stick her in a drawer. Obviously, things need to be different with our wives. There's a funny character on TV, a guy named Ron Swanson. He characterizes the stereotypical masculine point of view. He says this. He says, "The less I know about other people's affairs, the better. I'm not interested in caring about people. I once worked with a man for 3 years and never learned his name. Best friend I ever had. We still never talk sometimes." I thought that was funny. Obviously, it's a little bit exaggerated for humor's sake, but I think for some of us, just a little bit. Just a little bit exaggerated. Relationships with our wives obviously cannot be that way. We need to understand things differently with them. The Amplified Bible adds about this section of the verse by way of commentary. It says, "Live with your wives in an understanding way," and it adds, "with great gentleness intact, and with an intelligent regard for the marriage relationship." So if that means telling her you love her every day, even if you've already told her once already, then, you know, go ahead and do that. "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife," or value. Literally, this is appropriating value. Strong's says about this this section, "Esteem, especially of the highest degree, precious." The same word is regularly used of God himself in a number of different passages in the New Testament. And we're to treat her as the valuable person she is. Proverbs chapter 31, verse 10. I especially like how the CEV renders this. "A truly good wife is the most precious treasure a man can find." A truly good wife is the most precious treasure a man can find. As to the weaker vessel. Many scholars and commentators read this as giving honor to the wife, the weaker vessel. So they basically just ignore those words there. Or they say, "Husbands, dwell with your wives with understanding, giving honor to the wife, because she is the weaker vessel." And some versions even render it more or less that way. There may be some truth to that. Some people believe that Paul is talking about her physical abilities or cultural status in the first century. That might be the case, at least partially, but I don't know that was Paul's complete intent, because he does add those words, and if we just ignore certain words when we want, we might end up misunderstanding. So many scholars instead conclude Peter is saying something very different, and I tend to agree. They conclude that he's saying that because she's so valuable, as we've just noticed, because she's so valuable, we should treat her very gently. We should treat her very carefully, just like you would treat something that is valuable, a brand new car. You know, you're careful about shopping carts. Keep all the shopping carts away. You know, you don't want to scratch the paint. The thing's made out of steel and stuff. It's not going to get hurt. But if it's valuable to you, you take great care with it. I've got a visual aid. I brought one of Sam's plates. This is a plastic toddler plate. I think we got it from IKEA for like a dollar or something. I could frisbee this sucker, you know, all the way back to the back of the auditorium, and I wouldn't really care. It wouldn't matter. We could bury it in the yard for a year and then bring it out and be just fine, you know, stick it in the dishwasher. I don't value this much. We can treat it very roughly. If somebody steals it or if it gets nicked or something, we don't really care. We don't value this. Okay, on the other hand, carefully, I took this. My wife doesn't know. This is my wife's fine china. If I even think of frisbeeing this anywhere, I'm in big trouble. If I even stick it in the dishwasher, big trouble. It's not necessarily because it's fragile. It's because it's valuable to her. This has been handed down, I think, for a couple of generations. And it says it was made in France on the back, so that probably means it's important. But this is something that she values greatly. We don't ever really use them, but we spend a lot of money on this piece of furniture, a china cabinet, so we can display it for everybody to see how important it is, because it's valuable. We want to protect it, keep it behind glass. Don't touch it, Sam. Sam can touch this and throw this or whatever, but Sam's not allowed to touch this. It's behind glass. It's because she values this and she cares what happens to this. I think that's the idea that Paul's getting at here. Treat her as if she were a weaker vessel. She's so valuable, treat her like that. She's so valuable, treat her like that. I need to get this home without breaking. Don't tell Jeanette. Okay, so I think that is more what Paul is talking about there. We're commanded to treat our wives with such great care and understanding because God says they are worth so much. There's nothing more valuable that a man can have. Any less is unbecoming of anyone who wears the name of Christ. But practically speaking, what does that look like? We're commanded to understand them. We're commanded to value them. We are commanded to make a home with them. But in reality, the entire lectureship could be about that one topic idea next year, Brother Gary. But very quickly, what are some practical ways that we can do this? I conducted an informal survey of Christian wives, none here, so nobody's implicated in any of these questions. But here's what they said. The question was, what one thing do you wish your husband did? And this is all Christian wives. And what one thing do you wish your husband did? Pay attention, see if you notice any patterns. Helping without being asked. Know what needs to be done around the house without asking. My husband will do anything that I ask, but I get tired of having to ask. Pick up after himself. Be the leader. Be decisive. Lead and know his role as the head of the house. Pray and study the scriptures in front of his children. Pray together as a family. I really wish my husband would consistently do family Bible time. I wish my boys were learning that from him. And out of all of the comments that these ladies had, this one had the most likes. This was the most agreed with comment out of all of them. I wish my husband would do family Bible time consistently. Communication with an exclamation point. I didn't add that. Be present when at home. No thinking about work, talking about work, etc. Don't hide his feelings if something bothers or is troubling him. Learn to share feelings other than anger. Do slow activities with us, unplugged. Being present and focused on family when home. And then this last one. Learn my love language. It's very different from his. And his last one, if you don't know what a love language is, stop whatever you're doing. You can actually just leave now and go to the bookstore and go get the five light. No, you stay until we're done. But seriously, today, look up what that is. It will make your life a whole lot easier, and I think it will do a lot to improve your relationship. So this woman is saying, learn my love language is very different from his. If you do know what your wife's love language is, great. You're probably not doing it as much as you should, so set an alarm on your phone, repeating alarm every week, every day, however often you think you need to, and say, remember so-and-so's love language. Say something nice to her. Do something nice for her. If you were to ask her, if I were to ask your wife, is your husband communicating your love language enough to you? She'd probably say no. She might not you know, throw you under the bus, but she might say, you know, I really wish he did it just a little bit more. So everybody can improve there. according to our wives, husbands tend to fail in one or more of three areas, and these indeed are failures. And all of us are probably failing in at least one of these areas. Ask your wife if you're brave enough to see which area you're failing in, or which area you can improve in the most. Failure to help. This means we make our wife's life harder rather than easier. In other words, we're taking our wife for granted. We're taking our wife for granted. Failure to lead, we're too passive. Let me say that another way. She wants to follow you, but you're not going anywhere. Let me say that another way. You are not somebody worth following. If your wife says any of these things in this middle column, what she's saying is, my husband is not somebody worth following. And three, failure to connect. We often go on relational autopilot and fail to continually cultivate the intimacy our relationship deserves. In other words, you're not adequately valuing or understanding your wife. Yes, these are failures, and again, ask your wife, if you're brave enough, to see where you can improve. There's a satirical news website, Babylon Bee. It had its article recently, and just at the perfect time, I think it illustrates it perfectly. The headline is, "Man shows sacrificial Christ-like love for wife by throwing socks in general direction of laundry basket." And then from the article, it says, after reading Ephesians 5, local, and this is satire, obviously, but I think it's hitting close to home. After reading Ephesians 5, local man Kyle Nelson promised himself he'd begin to love his wife more sacrificially, quote, as Christ loved the church. He kicked off his new commitment by throwing his dirty socks in the general direction of the laundry hamper. Quote, when the world sees my radical Christ-like devotion to my wife, they'll start to think there's really something to this whole Christianity thing. He said proudly as he admired his handiwork, man, I'm a great spiritual leader. At publishing time, Nelson had quickly run a little bit of water over his used cereal bowl before piling it in the sink for his wife to do later in a radical act of Christian love. If that sounds anything like you, watch out. Before we wrap up, let's get some more practical tips, but from a man's perspective. These tips were put together by a man who nearly lost his wife. He freely admits that he went on relational autopilot. He was not the husband that he should have been, and his wife left him with their baby son. And as immature as he was, he said, I'm going to make some improvements in my life, not for my wife necessarily, but whoever the next person is that comes into my life, I'm going to be the best man I can for her. He inadvertently, in making these improvements and changes, he won his wife back, and he's doing quite well now. But these are his tips for men who are going through a similar situation, or men who want to avoid going through a similar situation. Number one, keep dating your wife after you're married. Life gets busy, we get jobs, we have children, our responsibilities pile up, but never get so busy that you can't take your wife out and treat her the way you did when you were attempting to win her. If the ladies were here, y'all would be getting some elbows, and there would be some nods, and all sorts of that. Number two, find a hobby she isn't part of and encourage her to do the same. If all your waking hours are spent with and revolving around one another, you're going to go crazy. You both need time to yourselves to come back into the relationship with more energy and enthusiasm. It's as the adage goes, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Three, talk with her about real things every single day. The verse that we read in Proverbs chapter 31, verse 10, the very next verse, after talking about how valuable a wife is to a husband, the very next verse says, his heart trusts in her. He placed his trust in her. So we need to be able to connect with and communicate with and engage with our wife in a way that we don't with anybody else. We need to be able to confide with her and really talk about things that matter. Things that matter. Not just what do you want for dinner. Talk about real things every single day. This will forge a connection that can't be replicated any other way. Number four, don't let kids become more important than your marriage. She was there first. She'll be there after the kids are grown. Set boundaries on your children. Put them into bed at a decent hour, so that you and your wife can have quiet time with one another. Here's another one. Remind her how important she is daily. A woman, a webcomic artist, she made this comic. And again, if the ladies were here, they would be saying, yep, that sounds just like me. That sounds just like me. Here it is. I think this is pretty funny. So here we have a young boy and a girl. And the boy says, I like you. And the girl says, what? Really? He says, yeah. And some time passes, and then they're getting married. And she's saying, you know, he's proposed and they're engaged. And she's saying, are you sure you like me? He says, I do. And they're getting married. After some time passes, they now have a baby. He's a dad, okay? And then she says, so you sure you won't change your mind? And the husband says, no. And then in an old folks' home, she's in a wheelchair. They're super old. This, after a long time has passed, she says, you don't think I'm weird? And he says, nope. And then after they're dead and they're ghosts, she says, so you definitely like me? And he says, yes. We as husbands might not need to hear, you know, honey, I love you. We might not need to hear that every day. Like, yeah, she told me already, right? But our wives, if they are not hearing this reassurance constantly, they're going to forget. They're going to question. They're going to doubt. You know, does he really love me? He hasn't told me today. You know, we need to tell them this. This was not written by a guy. This was written by a woman. It was a very, very popular comic online and resonated with a lot of people. So remind her how important she is daily. Number six, don't complain to her as often as you currently are. Don't complain to her as often as you currently are. Yes, talk with her about the problems you're dealing with when you need to, but be solution-oriented. Some things don't need to be complained about. If all you ever do is complain about how hard life is, how mean your boss is, office politics, etc., how do you think she's going to start viewing you? Stop complaining and start doing. Number seven, be a man of your word. Obviously, this means like not lying to her and not cheating on her and that kind of stuff. That's obvious. But also, this means when you say you're going to do something, whether it's taking out the trash, doing a project around the house, do it. Be a man of your word. And if you mess up, fix it quickly. This joke I found online, hey, if I say I'm going to do something, I'll do it. There's no need to remind me every 6 months. If that sounds anything like you, be a man of your word. Be a man of your word. Eight, include her in the decision-making process. The decisions that you make on behalf of your family will affect her too. She has to live with those results. And more importantly, she'll likely have a fresh perspective that perhaps you haven't considered. I've got a lot of wisdom from my wife. I've not really regretted asking my wife for feedback, at least not often. And number nine, focus on your family as much as you do your business. Some of us are workaholics. Some of us work is first, work is second, work is third. If that's you, focus on your wife or your family in particular as much as you do your business. Work is noble. We as men are commanded to work. We're commanded to support a family. We're commanded to take care of each other, of our families. You have a job to do, and this is very important. You have to provide. If you don't provide, you're worse than an infidel, an atheist. But remember that there are few husbands, there are few dads who on their deathbed say, man, I really wish I spent more time at work. I really wish I earned more money. It's okay to spend time at work. It's okay to do that. But remember some of the things that the lady said. I get sick and tired of him only talking about work. I get sick and tired of him working so much. I get sick and tired of him not having enough time for us, slowing down, and treating us like we're the priority. focus on the family as much as you do work. If we're going to restore the biblical view of the home, we need to start with our marriages. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk about fathers like I planned today, but Lord willing, we can continue that discussion next Sunday morning. Gary's going to be out of town. But I hope this has been half as useful for you as it has been for me. But let's commit to restoring God's view of the home by loving our wives and treating them as God expects us as men to. Thank you.